the only opening, then becomes the increased intensity, becomes an important phenomenal expression of the capitalist attack on labor. This leads these communists to misconstrue the whole question, to look at the struggle over productivity, the capitalist conception of productivity, and the socialist conception of productivity as the central pivotal issue, and forget its source. Why this blatant revisionism on this point, for example? The productivity is a problem for Russia. Russia shares with the capitalist world the struggle for increased productivity. And the bureaucrats in their own way drive for productivity. Here is an identity. Seize upon it. And again, they must also abstract the capitalists out of the capitalist system and replace them with a bureaucracy. A class that doesn't produce for private profit, but simply sort of attached to capital as the exploiter of labor. Custodian, whose master has died, now has the whole works for himself. He even participated in killing the master. To accomplish this abstraction of the capitalist class from the capitalist system and replacing it by the Stalin's bureaucracy, it's more easily done by removing from consideration this question of the rate of surplus value and pushing to the fore productivity. The exploitation relation is seen by Johnson Forrest as the domination of the machine over the worker, or the power of dead labor over living. In their use of these expressions, they assume a character of a fetishism. Absolutely no way around that. Marx described what is meant by a fetishism in the first volume of Capital, the fourth section of the first chapter. Such expressions like money is the root of all evil, money makes money, etc. A relation between persons concealed by an apparent relation between things. Money makes money only because the capitalist possession of it enables him to purchase the only value-creating commodity, labor power. And in Johnsonian economics, we see a development of a fetish of capital along the same line. Ford isn't necessary to the Ford enterprises. We can agree with that from the standpoint of the proletarian revolution. But he's very necessary to a capitalist Ford enterprise. What we have, they say, is a mass of capital that oppresses the worker. They take the Marxist understanding of the limitations imposed on the capitalist by the economic laws of value over which he has no control in order to eliminate the role of the capitalist without the proletarian revolution. Marx had a different notion of capitalism. Capitalists. He showed in great detail how these laws operate through the individual capitalist, determine his consciousness, and how that in turn affects the movement of the objective process. And the most safeguarded principle of capitalist law is freedom for investment. Capitalist wants to live without labor. He wants to make an honest dollar without soiling his hands. If I hear the word subjectivism again in relation to this, I'll have to say what one of the communists in Los Angeles said: we're not dealing with the movement of planets in sociology. We're dealing with human beings, classes. Marx was the first to understand that. Motivated by the struggle of privilege, economic gain. That's the capitalist class. It isn't an automaton like your worker. The right to appropriate the surplus labor of others is the cardinal principle of capitalist production. The drive to increase productivity is only the means to this end, and not the end in itself. I want to turn to another aspect of this whole question, to the political aspect. We want to intervene in Yugoslavia, in the Tito-Stalin split. The start with. In order to help in the process of developing a world party of revolution. To us, the appearance of the split in the ranks of world Stalinism was the occasion of probing every possibility. Find the revolutionary forces, help them find their way to Trotskyism. And to us, this is of prime importance because we see the problem of the world revolution. That is the problem of humanity. As the problem of creating the requisite revolutionary leadership, an irreconcilable struggle with Stalinism, centrism, and reformism. This concept, comrades of the Johnson Forest tendency wish to throw out of the window, along with all of Trotskyism. One doesn't have to dig and imply, this is what they state. They say, on page 33 of their recent document, the first sentence of the transitional program states that the crisis of revolution is the crisis of revolutionary leadership. This is the reiterated theme. And they say exactly the opposite is the case. It is the crisis of the self-mobilization of the proletariat. As we shall show, and it is perfectly obvious logically, this theme of orthodox Trotskyism implies that there is a competition for leadership, and that whereas the other internationals have betrayed, the fourth international will be honest. Exactly the contrary must be the analysis. Here we want to ask, why was the proletariat defeated since 1917? It's not an unimportant question. It's perhaps the question that our movement has preoccupied itself with, as well as the corollary question, how can the proletariat come to victory? He who does not know the reason for these defeats cannot prepare victory. It is not a crisis of leadership, but of the self-mobilization of the masses. In all the situations where the mass mobilization of the proletariat reached the highest point of intensity, Germany, 1918 to 1923, China, Spain, France, Europe after the Second World War, why were they defeated? Were they doomed in advance? Had the stage of state capitalism failed to appear in sufficient development to mature the conditions? This is ludicrous. It isn't even contended. Is it because the objective situation was unripe? The working class practically took power into its hands over and over again, as far as their self-mobilization was concerned. It isn't that they didn't even reach the point of taking power. They took the power. It was snatched from their hands by the leadership. In every case, it was a problem of the crisis of leadership. It remains only to blame the proletariat. Or to descend into mysticism. Johnson Forest tendency reject a contest for leadership. That is, they reject the struggle to build a revolutionary party. They hurl the Bolshevik conception over their right shoulder and they assign the task to the proletariat. Mobilize yourselves and we will act as an expression of your self-mobilization. They talk about the unique situation of mass parties that appeared suddenly on the scene after the Second World War. They say, blind to facts, they say, Lenin never conceived of a mass party of 2.5 million before the struggle for power. I can't for the life of me understand what they mean by this. A party of 2.5 million, that must be the Italian Communist Party. It must mean that that's a unique feature of the modern development. The proletariat mobilizes in large parties. But wherein is this unique? Before the First World War, we had the mass mobilization of the proletariat in the Second International. After the First World War, in the Second and Third International, in the interim between the two wars, and after the Second World War, aside from that, it's very unique. We contend that the element of the readiness of the proletariat, or its self-mobilization, if you please, has over and over again demonstrated itself. He who does not understand that the struggle, yes, the contest for leadership, is like the Bolsheviks contested for leadership against the social revolutionaries and the Mensheviks, will help the working class realize this self-mobilization victory. That's what the struggle is about. Now, in this theory, the Stalinists are assigned a historic role. They're not class collaborationists. Let me quote this. The Stalinists are not class collaborationists, fools, cowards, idiots, men with supple spines, but conscious, clear-sighted aspirants for world power. They are deadly enemies of private property capitalism. They aim to seize the power, take the place of the bourgeoisie. When they support a war or do not support, support the bourgeoisie or do not support, they know exactly what they are doing. The bourgeoisie also knows. In fact, everybody, including most workers, know this, except Orthodox Trotskyism. There's a strange disclosure in this passage. There's even a grain of truth in it. The popular opinion is faithfully stated. It really is true that almost everybody holds this point of view, including the non-Orthodox Trotskyists. They all hold the view that Stalinism is a revolutionary force. They divide on Stalinism as a matter of taste. Stalinists and some sections of the neo-Stalinists, it's a revolutionary force, that's good enough. Let's not fool around with 10th-rate issues of method and ethics and all the rest of that. The bourgeoisie, and all their ideologists and theoreticians, call it a revolutionary force, mortal enemies of the capitalist system. And the Johnson Forest tendency calls it a revolutionary force if you want to think things through. The methodology is the same. They only add that this whole revolution, the elimination of the whole capitalist system as we know it, that's only a change in the stage of capitalism. Doesn't require the proletarian intervention. And they say, moreover, this stage brings the revolution closer than ever before. Why? That we don't know. A very revolutionary conception that the revolution is closer than ever before. But when it's taken up in regard to concrete questions of revolutionary action of the proletariat, everything changes. When the real proletariat moves, that is that proletariat weighed down by false leadership, that proletariat which has Stalinist and social democratic leadership, that proletariat we ignore. Little wonder that they reject our whole conception of the Yugoslav Revolution and our tasks. Now, a typical question raised by comrades in all parts of the country who have expressed certain reservations about our resolution is as follows. Did we call it a worker state because of the indications of a favorable leftward development in the ideological life of the YCP? You can see at once that that method would lead to great difficulties because we have a very unfavorable development and the right would turn in foreign policy. Surely our resolution and our method isn't predicated on that superficial premise. We call it a worker state because upon investigation, thought, the collective work of our whole movement nationally, by examining the dynamics of the revolution, the class relations in that revolution, the workers destroyed the capitalist state apparatus, and with a whole series of moves characterized by stumbling, lack of consciousness, ideological lags, they erected their own state apparatus and took the power. That's the basic reason, and then proceeded to transform the country socially and economically. The break with the Kremlin gave us a clue. No one will deny this. There were some perspicacious comrades in periodicals of the Fourth International that saw the development in its earliest phase. I read an article by Comrade Wright in 1943. Put its finger on the heart of the development of the revolution at that time. It starts out with the idea a civil war is taking place in Yugoslavia and we take sides in that civil war. It's only necessary to bring the analysis up to date. Now I have a few minutes for a brief presentation of what is called the related question. I want to explain, I don't think the chairman did, that I'm on my own now. I was speaking for the majority of the political committee. Although maybe a point here and there wasn't quite right, but here I take full responsibility. I can really go wild. But what I really want to do is attempt to characterize this international discussion that we've had. There are really three questions under discussion. Yugoslavia, which I won't deal with any further. The buffer zone and the nature of the Stalinist parties throughout the world. I want to remark here that the Johnson Forest tendency entered this discussion with a cry of chaos. The house is burning down. Everybody run. Look at all the opinions. Look at all the conflicting currents in the discussion. This is chaos. We weren't impressed by that cry. Our view is the opposite. It's the richest, most profound ideological discussion our international has experienced since the death of the old man. The discussion, in every respect, has been tied to the best traditions of conscientious Marxist method. In the first place, it's a discussion that takes account of facts. Like on the Russian question, I always remember the old man used to dig up the facts, analyze them painstakingly from week to week, write books and pamphlets about them. The ultra-leftists and the centrists, they never bothered with that question. They took the facts as Trotsky presented them. And then as he said, where he drew the figure of a woman's face, they made a mustache. If he had a chicken, they put an egg under it. Just caricaturizing the real analysis. I think we should be proud of the fact that our comrades have followed in the very best tradition of Trotsky's method. They watch the developments, explore. I think another thing that's important about this discussion is that despite the fact that it deals with the most profound questions of the epoch, entailing the very basic criteria of Marxism, it has been a discussion in the freest and most comradely spirit. And that in that sense, no one has felt pinned down, no one has felt forced to defend everything you said yesterday in a factional sense. The logic of the discussion, it appears to me, has been to arrive at clarity and even agreement on very important points. And as for chaos, the first expression of chaos, ideological chaos in the workers' movement, is its incapacity to act. Paralysis, multiplication of views on what to do in every situation. And more often than not, abstentionism. Do nothing. Discuss. The Fourth International has shown every tendency while conducting a theoretical discussion to act decisively and in a unified way in all the basic turning points of the world situation. That too is evidence of the nature of this discussion. Up to now, the big point in the discussion has been, what is the class character of the buffer zone? What attitude should we take to it tactically? Difficulty arises, in my opinion, not from the first period, where it was clear and evident that the Stalinist bureaucracy moved in as part of a deal with Allied imperialism after crushing the Axis. A deal in which the clear and simple bargain was that the Stalinists would crush the revolution in Europe, which they did, and in Eastern Europe. In return, they would get territory. First period, I don't think, offers theoretical difficulties. Capitalist class, although great numbers of them had fled, taken all their possessions out of the country, I think the Stalinists managed to get a hold of enough of them to put them into cabinets and to try to install a capitalist stability and to deal with them. For my part, as more development and more information comes, the important feature is the sweeping elimination of capitalism. Expropriation by the military bureaucratic method. The question arises, shall we then call them degenerated worker states? In my opinion, the difficulty with this formula is that to us, the degenerated worker state is an inclusive definition. And included in that definition is a victorious revolution which suffered degeneration and counter-revolutionary Stalinist growth. And this does not correspond, that type of definition taken in its rich meaning does not correspond to the reality in the buffer zone. And we then say neither worker states nor capitalist states, a new phenomena. But we are all agreed that this phenomena, and it has certain new aspects undoubtedly, notwithstanding the Baltics and Eastern Poland, we're all agreed that it's a limited, historically unviable, a byproduct of a byproduct. My own view is that the whole process has been one of destroying these states as states, incorporating them in one form or another into the USSR. The bureaucratic military method in the first place of social transformations leaves no room for independent existence. Does this elimination of capitalism in such a large section of Europe open up a re-evaluation of Stalinism? I don't think so, not at all. If we see the processes in its entirety, we see that the first and foremost function of Stalinism was to crush the real vital force, the revolutionary proletariat, in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe. And to leave then the whole process to become mangled and deformed in the hands of the bureaucracy. Nothing at all is revolutionary about Stalinism. And as regards the Stalinist parties, in my opinion, the best example, and here I return to Yugoslavia, is the lesson to be learned from Yugoslavia. Stalinist parties can be transformed. I see that that's a basic new thought in our program. If we can't take parties, or if history doesn't take parties that have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of worker adherents, and in the crises of revolution, transform these parties, split them, break them up, introduce all forms of changes in them, then it leads to a conception of the incapacity of the proletariat. Our task is simply to recognize where, how, and when these transformations take place, and to intervene. It opens possibilities of regroupment of forces to the Trotskyist party. We must find that every new situation, as Trotsky taught us, the premises for revolutionary action in each new situation, erode to the masses, to help them tear loose from Stalinism and capitalism. I want to conclude with the question of the right swing in foreign policy in Yugoslavia. Its basic reasons are not unknown to us. We have traced them. They are traced in this resolution. Yugoslavia, as a workers' revolution in a backward country, besieged by both the power of the Kremlin and world imperialism, enormous difficulties in the development of that revolution. We have to point to another factor, aside from the momentary and very important fact of a drought and a threatened famine. You have the continuation of the centrism of the YCP. You have two contrary trends. Internally, the revolution and the policy of the Revolutionary Party has been moving leftward, even beyond some of our best expectations. Externally, in foreign policy, there has been a rapid shift to the right. One has to understand that these two problems will not be isolated, as the Yugoslavs hope. They will meet, and they will come back home. The demands of the Vatican, for example, and of all the capitalist agencies about freedom for prisoners, are not simply a civil liberties demand, I assure you. They're trying to knock out one of the fundamental props of the existence of the workers' state in Yugoslavia. The constant pressure of the peasantry, of the richer middle peasantry on the workers' state must be understood. They try to break through the monopoly of foreign trade or the restrictions on the free market. The workers' state is compelled to use measures of imprisonment and action against these capitalist elements. The demand will broaden. Lay off these people. Introduce the free market. Give us concessions. One thing after another. If these centrists, empiricists, imagine that they're going to outwit Truman, that is to say Wall Street, they could outwit Truman. Imagine they're going to outwit Wall Street. They'll find out differently. They'll be taken by the throat. The real demand will be placed. We've got to watch for that. There's no doubt that great harm and damage has been done. The prestige of the Yugoslav revolution to the consciousness of the world working class and the possibilities of alliances with the colonial people. But the issue is not decided. We do not put a cross over the Yugoslav revolution on the basis of this very ominous trend. Our task is not only to criticize the Yugoslav Communist Party, and we must criticize them. We have to expose the murderous squeeze of Wall Street. We have to do everything in our power to arouse pressure against the squeeze, to expose what they are doing. We will watch with great interest and as partisans of the struggle every further development. The extension of the October Revolution and the defense of all its conquests from imperialist attack, that has been the strategic line of our movement. The Yugoslav Revolution, despite all its ebbs and flows, is a gigantic step forward for the world proletariat. And now for us, the defense of the Yugoslav Revolution from both the rapacious designs of imperialism and the threatening attack of counter-revolutionary Stalinism now enters as an integral part of our strategic line.
Chairman, comrades. The reporter for the majority well merited the ovation he received. It was a report worthy of the 14th convention of our party. I shall do my best to keep the discussion on the high level to which he has raised it. I learned a lot in this greatest university of our movement. I am sure the convention as a whole, with a few exceptions, learned too. About the majority reporter's tact, restraint, and grace, to say nothing of his encyclopedic knowledge of the most esoteric literature, has ever been my fortune, or rather misfortune, to be acquainted with. As to matching him in that, I don't know. I associate myself, of course, wholeheartedly with that section of his speech devoted to the political and economic treatment of the Forrest Johnson School. And although it will take up the time of the convention, as well as my own, it would be impermissible to simply say that and go on, even though the treatment was comprehensive, considering the brief time it had to be packed in. It is necessary, in my opinion, for me to touch upon one aspect of the Forrest Johnson economic theory. One of their lesser claims contributions is that they have superseded Lenin, at least so far as the theory of imperialism is concerned. Now let's take that proposition that their theory of state capitalism supersedes the theory of imperialism. Let's take it from the standpoint of the dialectical content. Imperialism is decay. State capitalism is far, far worse decay. You can't get any further. It's absolute. You pass from one stage of decay to its utmost stage. Lenin thought capitalism had reached its highest final stage with imperialism. Well, he's been proved wrong, to the satisfaction at least of a group of comrades. Now, how is that dialectical transition achieved from decay to the same category at a higher stage? Through revolution. Now, Engels used to find Hegel's transitions enjoyable. Lenin did not. He admitted they often gave him headaches. This transition of the Forrest Johnson school appears to be dialectical in form. But when you look at the content, it's nonsense. There can be no such dialectical transitions. Let's take it on the economical plane. If imperialism is the highest stage, is not the highest stage of capitalism, capitalist development, but state capitalism is, you would expect to find it by all the rules, at least the formal logic, to manifest itself in the most advanced countries in the world. Where should decay be most manifest? And along with it, its expression, state capitalism, if not in the most advanced country. That is the United States. Imperialism found its expression, highest expression, in Lenin's day in the most advanced countries. Where do the Forrest Johnson School find it? In the most backward countries in the world. They were, at least, before the revolution opened the door to this decay. I'm sure state capitalism in Yugoslavia from their point of view. Let me pass on now to their system of philosophy. In this field, they skirt dangerously close, if not become virtually identifiable with the opponents of not only dialectical materialism, but the materialist school of thought as a whole. What they call their universals, especially their all-embracing universals, unfold in history and materialize in history in a manner strikingly reminiscent of the unfoldment and the materialization of Hegelian absolute idea. The universal of Johnson Forrest, like the absolute of Hegel, materializes only when history is fully ripe for it, and not an instant before. Just as the all-embracing universal Hegel called the absolute. If you want their philosophy in a nutshell, you will find it on page 66 of their latest bulletin, although I may be a little behind the times. I'll read it to you. All previous distinctions, politics and economics, war and peace, agitation and propaganda, party and mass, individual and society, national, civil and imperialist war, single country and one world, immediate needs and ultimate solutions. All these it is impossible to keep separate any longer. Total planning is inseparable from the permanent crisis, the world struggle for the minds of men, from the world tendency to complete mechanization of men. Now what's there left out of this formula in the real world as we know it? Nothing. Now one must indeed use a special method, special spectacles, to obtain such a view of our world today. You can do it by using the method of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Trotsky. That's correct. But this method does fall in its own special way within the province of the German school of dialectic philosophy, And you may add old Hegel to it too. But to give him his due, Mr. Hegel, he never imposed such inexorable necessity on his system as the Forrest Johnson tendency do on theirs. Hegel was far more flexible. He at least left ample room for the interplay between chance necessity and necessary chance. Let me now pass on to the defense of the resolution, the memorandum that is before you. My task has been made much easier by the historical review and its analysis presented to you by the majority reporter, especially the treatment of the problem of dual power, to which the burden of the rest of my remarks will be committed. As the discussion on Yugoslavia passed through its different phases, all the more acutely has the problem of dual power confronted us. This problem, superimposed on the dispute over criteria or method of to employ in characterizing a revolution, tangled up still more the already complicated Yugoslav question. I am sorry to say that on the question of dual power, many comrades have proceeded as empirically as they did on a question of criteria. Some of our co-thinkers, and the reporter himself, and it's also in the majority resolution, made an important contribution toward the solution of the problem we are trying to solve. And that is that you cannot solve it at a stroke, because it wasn't solved that way in Yugoslavia. It can only be solved in stages. Is this consistent with our theory and historical facts? Indeed, it is. Let me review the problem as it appears historically. The English Revolution of the 17th century posed the problem of dual power, as every revolution does. There it was solved in several stages. This revolution, wrote the old man, was a clear example of this alternating dual power with sharp transitions in the form of civil war. The great French Revolution of the 18th century was solved in a much more complicated way. Here, the revolution not only ascended, but also the counter-revolution descended, as the old man put it, by steps of dual power. And each of the stages was characterized by a sharply marked double sovereignty. All this took place over a period not of weeks or months, but I repeat, several years. Now, as this appearance over entire prolonged periods of conditions in society where you cannot say that this or that class has the power, is that consistent with our basic theoretical approach? I turn now to the good book. That is the history of the Russian Revolution. to the chapter on dual power, where the old man poses this very question. Does this phenomenon of the dual power, heretofore not sufficiently appreciated, contradict the Marxian theory of the state, which regards the government as an executive committee of the ruling class? This is just the same as asking, he says, does the fluctuation of prices under the influence of supply and demand contradict the labor theory of value? Does the self-sacrifice of a female protecting her offspring refute the theory of a struggle for existence? No. In these phenomena, we have a more complicated combination of the same laws. If the state is an organization of class rule, and a revolution is the overthrow of the ruling class, then the transfer of power from one class to another must necessarily create self-contradictory state conditions. And first of all, the form of dual power. Now, let me repeat this. When you're dealing with dual power, within it, you have one stage of dual power passing into another stage of dual power, possibly a civil war intervening, another stage of dual power, until and unless the relationship is stabilized and the question is no longer posed through class relations as to who is the master at home. In Yugoslavia, what have we had in terms of stages? At least one civil war, and following it, at least four distinct governments. There was the Avnoj, the anti-fascist Council of Liberation, established the Bihać in November 1941. There was the Tito Subasic United Yugoslav National Government, formally announced in March 1945, but first negotiated in June of 44 and agreed to in principle by the end of 44. This government terminates existence in October 1945 and was followed by another government, which continued until the kicking out of the Stalinist ministers in Tito's cabinet. I believe it was sometime in 1948. If the withdrawal of the last two bourgeois ministers in 1945 cannot be overlooked by us, neither then can we dismiss as an important governmental change of kicking out the two most prominent and powerful Stalinist ministers in this same cabinet. Now, no one can simply by inspection, from determining at least the number of stages and governments you've had, then attempt to characterize the nature of these successive governments. You can't do it by inspection. Next, you must at least establish the specific peculiarities of the whole process. Truth is concrete. Now let me now list some of these peculiarities, not necessarily in the order of their importance. First, the admittedly prolonged duration of dual power. Some of our co-thinkers have proposed that we accept the period of 45-46 as the date when dual power was finally completely resolved and a new state was born. If you count from Bihać, this fixes approximately 5 to 6 years as falling into dual power. If you count Yeltsin, he gives you a year less. Some members of the majority say it was longer, others say it was shorter. From my analysis and study, I am firmly convinced that the year 1950 also falls under that heading. There is still a dual power system in Belgrade. Peculiarity number two, the highly contradictory character of the entire process. The Yugoslav revolution has evolved in extremely tortuous ways, marked by sudden halts, which have been preceded and followed by dizzy swings, now to the right, now to the left. Let me illustrate. Shortly after the Nazis overran Yugoslavia, the YCP issued a call for insurrection. That's certainly a swing to the left, as compared especially with previously followed policy. But no sooner was this done than the YCP leadership starts scurrying around for allies, People's Front allies, anything and anybody except fascists and collaborators. And above all, Draža Mihailović and his Chetniks, who had also set up a certain dual power system. That certainly was a swing to the right. Negotiations with Mihailović fall through, and the partisans fight on their own, now battling both the fascists plus Mihailović. That's a swing to the left. You get more negotiations with Mihailović. That's a swing to the right. You get a final break with Mihailović. Swing to the left. You get the formation of the Avnoy. That's certainly a swing to the left. And then apparently the Kremlin has become a very important factor in the situation and tones down the program and propaganda. A swing to the right. The extremely convulsive movements in the early days take place, of course, and are explained by conditions of civil war. The war is over, the tempo tends to slow down. But throughout, you get the same alterations. Skipping to 1948, the break with the Kremlin, obviously a swing to the left. And for a period of a whole, almost 2 years, an attempt to reach some sort of deal, some sort of a status quo agreement, certainly a swing to the right. And of course, as Comrade Weissel pointed out, this year we witnessed both the sharpest swing to the left and the sharpest swing to the right since the coalition government with the Yugoslav bourgeoisie in 45. Now, such convulsive zigzags have their origin not alone in the character of a given leadership and its particular policy, but also in the unstable correlation of class forces inside the country, which create a self-contradictory situation, which is transmitted through the leadership precisely because of its particular character, which is dual in a different sense. It's dual in that it expresses a pressure not of a single class, but of at least two classes when it happens to be centrist. This alteration of swings coincides with the peaks in the stages that follow in a dual power condition. It's one of the characteristics and one of the reasons why I cannot accept the revolution as accomplished. Let me say in passing that those comrades who persist in employing a single factor or group of factors, nationalizations, for example, reforms, for example, as the decisive criterion to characterize a revolution in Yugoslavia or anywhere else, are only hindering their own education. And that wouldn't be so bad, it's bad enough, but that hinders the education of the party. Let me go on to the third peculiarity, the character of the Yugoslav party. Here we have something peculiar to the point of uniqueness. A centrist party plunging into a civil war, leading it, winning it, and remaining in power to this very day. This has never happened before. Not in the history of proletarian struggles. Can we say, really, it was a Stalinist party, as some comrades incline? Here I go much further than they apparently are prepared to. Its basic cadre was undoubtedly trained in a Stalinist school, but the party as a whole, as it passed through this experience, in its vast majority, received its training in the battlefields of the Civil War. How many members this party originally started with? I don't think anybody really knew. But it is common knowledge that it was in no sense a mass party at the outset. Probably not much larger than our own cadre, if that large. Certainly nowhere near as large as the one that emerged from the Civil War. Now, Comrade Stewart, on the basis of scanty and extremely tendentious information available years ago, deduced from the partisan program that this party must have lost all contact with Moscow. This truly noteworthy contribution to our clear understanding of the Yugoslav events at the time passed unnoticed. This has since then been fully confirmed. The opportunity of this party to pass through such an experience, relatively brief though it may have been, in a condition of civil war, being able to operate independently from Stalin's intervention, left an indelible imprint from the cadres. And that took place quite early. It may well have played a decisive role in molding the Potter's fighting ranks and leadership, as Comrade Clark suggests. There is in addition another circumstance that I recommend very strongly to the comrades' consideration. It merits very close study. The YCP, from the beginning of organized partisan activity to the end of the Civil War, was more of an army than a political party as we know it. In this respect, you can draw a certain parallel between the political role of the army under Cromwell and that of the partisans under Tito. And also, there is a parallel in the form of dual power assumed. In both cases, we find what Trotsky called a territorial form of dual power with swiftly shifting boundaries. Now, there's not only a tendency to agree, there's complete agreement here with the presentation of the majority report. This parallel is all the more interesting because Stalin, unlike Cromwell in all other respects, nevertheless, like Cromwell, eventually learned that army parties readily give birth to new dual power systems. In Cromwell's case, the dual power of the levelers never had a chance to unfold. It was easily nipped in the bud because this class it represented had not yet historically matured. In Stalin's case, it proved otherwise. The dual power system of the partisan succeeded in surviving. Let's come now to peculiarity number four. But before I do that, you must weigh things before you decide that this was really a Stalinist party at the beginning. Not that I'm one of those who think that a party that is actually Stalinist, not only in its formal training, but through and through, cannot, under certain conditions, move away from Stalinism. It would be rash to do so. But in my opinion, it is extremely significant that, say, in China, you had an army party. And the Chinese Stalinists, while you must draw distinctions, in that respect, appear to have passed, under different conditions, through an experience similar to that in Yugoslavia. Let's come to peculiarity number four. In a private conversation, one comrade put it about as follows. In Yugoslavia, events seem to have unfolded just the reverse of the Russian Revolution. Under the Bolsheviks, first came the seizure of power, then came civil war. Under the partisans, first came the civil war and the seizure of power in the sense of the proletarian revolution sometime later. Now, I couldn't quite make out clearly what Murray's own date is. But some of our co-thinkers insist on Yaitse of 1943. Yaitse unquestionably played an important role in the history of the Yugoslav Civil War, in the evolution of the partisan movement, and perhaps also in the succession of partisan dual power systems that follow. But one thing is sure, Bihać is at least as important. Bihać is the Bosnian town where 1 year earlier than Yaitse, the Avnoj was actually launched, paving the way for the Yaitse meeting. The partisans at Bihać did not formally assume, let me single out Yaitse, also say that what emerged there was a workers' and peasants' government, de jure, a legally constituted one. If you assume that that is so, it is necessary then also to grant that there was at least a de facto workers' and peasants' government set up at Bihać. Personally, I would much rather use Trotsky's formula for an army party form of dual power than the transitional formula he supplied in the foundation program and used by Carmen Germain. I think it is far more correct to define both Bihać and Yaitse as a territorial form of dual power set up by the partisans. In any case, if we mean the same thing, both of us, a compromise on terminology can readily be reached. But do we? Is it properly recognized that not only the same parties, but the very same leaders participated, both at Bihać and Yaitse? How many parties were there? You heard, one, and only one. That's precisely because why? All the other parties, especially the peasant parties, became so discredited. That's why all the other leaders in Yugoslavia, formerly politically permanent, prominent, pardon me, lost all their prestige, their following, and some later even their lives. The slew of other so-called parties and groups allegedly comprising the liberation movement were all facades for the partisans, and little more. It was this party army that won and led the civil war. Now what happened then? The partisan dual power system ceded place to a Tito-Subasic coalition. The ruling party still remained the same as at Bihać and Yaitse. So did all the leading figures, barring a few notable exceptions, such as Kardelj, who now became a deputy foreign minister for Subasic. Six capitalist ministers walked in and were given cabinet posts with or without portfolios. It was characterized here as a Trojan horse policy, followed by the coalition and by the Kremlin, agreed to by the Kremlin. Now it's wrong to dismiss this as a mere episode. It marked a new stage in dual power, the emergence of a new dual power system, with the Trojan horse policy apparently in reverse. Because from all indications, the bourgeois ministers were virtual captives in Tito's cabinet. At any rate, Foreign Minister Subasic was. At the first Big Five Council meeting of ministers held in London during the Tito-Subasic regime, it was attended by Kardelj and not Subasic.